Today, I'm going to tell you about the Value Education Program. We started at the beginning of 2001. I was called to headquarters by Nirvarbhai and Daddy Jenki because the Brahma Kumaris had just signed an agreement with the University of Mysore to prepare a syllabus on education in values. And this is because the government of India had called for this, saying that we need to have education in values in the conventional education system. And the problem is, or the problem was, what to teach people, how to teach people. And so we had to really go back to square one and think about this. Because if you look at the large perspective of this subject, values, ethics, morality, I suppose everyone's parents must have told you, do like this, don't do like that, this is good, this is not good. This is how our family does. And then you'd be a good person, a good citizen, whatever your nationality is. There's something about if you live a life of values and morality that makes you a better, you know, a real Englishman, a good German, an excellent Swede, a good Indian. Yes? And then when you go to school, your teachers tell you, do like this, don't do like that. So it's not like people don't know. And then when you go to your church or your synagogue or your temple, then the religious leaders also give you sermons, do like this. Don't do like that. This is right. This is wrong. So we get it from three what we call external moral authorities. The parents and the external family, your educators, and your religious leaders. So it's paradoxical that the government came up with the idea, or they did a study and found out that the problem that we have, and this is not just India, this is pretty much everywhere, that what we're suffering from is an ethical crisis. And the signs of it, crime rates are going up, corruption, violence, all sorts of things, which you all know about. So given this paradox, and also given the fact that there are a number of programs already in place, like in India there's something called moral science. Nobody likes going to moral science class because it's sort of heavy and it's moralizing and all that. So we had to figure out a way to talk about these things which is current and interesting and relevant. If you look at the history of character development, you find that we get given guidance, excellent guidance in the scriptures, in the philosophies, in the literature. And so if we have ended up with a crisis, it means that all of these things have failed. So you can imagine that it's a bit daunting to try and do something which succeeds, where the major religions and philosophies and great literature and poetry of the world has not succeeded. But what we have is one special ingredient, and that was really a very important ingredient to identify. And that is why we called this program Education in Values and Spirituality, because the missing ingredient is spiritual power. Think about it. Everybody has a conscience, yes? Everybody has a conscience. Even if nobody would ever tell you, this is right, this is wrong, do like this, don't do like that, you have a mechanism inside that lets you know from the inside. And as you grow, you refine and develop your own idea about what's right and what's wrong. And sometimes you go against your own principles. Yes? And sometimes when you're faced with a moral dilemma, the voice of your conscience says, I think that's not quite right. And you say, well, I need to do it because, you see? And we disregard the voice of conscience for one reason or another. It might be because we want something that we don't really have a right to. It might be because we're afraid that if we don't get it like this way, then we won't get it at all. So we do something manipulative. You see what I mean? So we found that what we need to do is really look carefully at what is a value. And this is really not something for children to figure out. This is something for people who are facing the realities of life. You know, you go through childhood, you go through school, and you're protected by your parents. But once you start to be an adult, once you get out there into the work world, you may get married, you may start your family, and you then become the external moral authority for somebody else. This is really the time when you need this kind of education. And what we find is most people's formal education about right and wrong stops when they're really quite young. Because once you become a teenager, you're really not interested in hearing any more of those things. Isn't that right? So then you reach the stage of a young adult and you don't really have what you need for managing this aspect of life. And so we position this program for people in their, say, around the age of 20, 25, up to, say, around 60. Because this is the period of time where you are most active in some form of leadership. So what I'm going to do is just turn on this projector here and show you very briefly an outline of the syllabus that we've created. It is called A Diploma of Education in values and spirituality. It's a postgraduate diploma. So you can see it's an educational program, higher education, and it's very, very much oriented for BKs. We took Baba's Gyan and we put it systematically in secular language, focusing on how to understand what a value is, and also putting it together with the, what have we got here? Also putting it together with the, a diploma. It's a course of study, but it's for people who don't have time to study, people who are really mostly older than the studying age range. And so we have actually divided it up into a series of 10 certificate programs. And so these are about 5 days, residential. So you come here or any other residential BK campus, and you can study this very intensively, where you develop your spiritual power, because unless you develop yourself spiritually, you cannot actually develop your values, because the lack of values, or whenever we go against our values, occurs purely and simply because our level of spiritual power is down. So this is really the new ingredient in this. We have a website that you can look at, which is www.valueeducation.org. And we're going to, during this year, develop it quite a lot so that anyone from any part of the world can listen to audio files and see PowerPoints and various other items, so that you can really self-educate. So we have these two ways in which you can do it. And ideally, you come and do a course, or you do the whole series of courses, and you sustain yourself through the other items that are there through the website, which keep on getting added to. So the kinds of people that we're interested in is professionals, English-speaking graduates. We have a Hindi translation of some portion of the course, so that is also in the form of a brief certificate course. We're experimenting with very new ideas, and we use very new kind of educational technologies. So it's not just the conventional way of somebody sitting up here like me and telling you this is right and that is wrong. But we use dialogue systems, we use questionnaires, we use all kinds of ways in which people are fully participating and discovering that anyway all of us know these things, but it's really a matter of bringing what we know to the surface and setting aside some of the negative impacts of moralizers that have happened. The books we have here, and they basically look like this. There are a total of 12 in the series, but we have published up to 10 of them. And I've brought some samples of them so you can have a look. And if you want to get some, then you should come to the hall number 12 in the Academy for a Better World up here, and you can get that. So you've got about, you see, 120 pages of text, photographs. There are theoretical modules and practical modules, and the continuing sustenance after the course. Each module is a certificate course in the present format, and so we run through usually 3 units. Some of them are 2 units, and so it begins with looking at the essentials of values, what exactly a value is and why they're necessary. And then in the second course, we move on to the relationship between spirituality and values, and there you look more detail how to develop the values and what kinds of challenges you might expect internally and externally. And then we look at this quite delicate subject of religion, spirituality, and secularism. The third course takes a look at the religions. We've selected the 6 main religions that are practiced in India. Some of them are theistic, some of them are non-theistic. All of them talk about values in slightly different ways, and they all have many things in common. We need to look at the religions because most people feel that the religions are actually the source of values. And what we find in these studies of the religions is that there's a higher source. And so we also go to that. Now, in the 4th module, we look at the areas that the religions are not completely clear on, or they don't give adequate detailed information. So, because we need to know about consciousness, what consciousness is, because when your consciousness is, or when you're unclear about consciousness and unclear about the idea that you are the consciousness, then it's not possible to develop values because they lie actually in your consciousness. And then we look at the Supreme Being, Shiv Baba, God, as the source of values. So one thing is that we need to develop a higher consciousness. And second, we need to be able to draw spiritual power into ourselves from the Supreme Being in order to be able to actually take what we know about values as a real reality so that they then become expressed in our day-to-day life. And this is done through meditation. And so the 5th module is all about how to meditate. Then we have a very interesting interactive positive thinking process. And how did we get there? Then we go into some of the very deeper parts, the emotional maturity. One of the things that mitigates against us actually living according to what we believe is the immaturity. The childishness, the inability to manage our emotions. And so we look at that. The 6th one is about different values. And this is particularly useful for parents. I think one of the biggest problems in the conventional society is that the adults think that the children have no values and they don't have any consideration and so on. What we found in our research is that children actually mimic the adult population. And so when the parents have a problem with their children, the problem is really originating with the parents, and the parents had a problem with their parents, and so it goes on through the generations. So we can't really blame anyone here. But what we need to do is look at some new ways of parenting practices, and also bearing in mind that parents, teachers, and religious leaders are seen by the children as role models, and they copy them. The problem happens when the moral authorities say one thing, and then they do some other thing, and then the children say, you know, what is this? And they don't bother with them, because they can see hypocrisy. So the child then experiences a degree of personal trauma, because on the one hand, these are the people for whom the child has the greatest respect. And on the other hand, these people are doing the opposite of what they say, so therefore, either you have to lose respect for them, or you have to pretend that they're not really doing against what they say. Either way, it's traumatic for the child. And so the child reacts to this trauma with bad behavior of one kind or another, which the adults then start punishing them from. And then it creates quite a negative cycle, which results in adult years in increased crime, violence, corruption, and so on. And so again, this is why we decided the insertion point for talking about values is when you are an adult and you're starting to really operate as an independent person in the social, familial, and professional world. And then we also, because there was a great demand, a lot of people feel that the way that you learn values is in a list. Honesty, compassion, truth, mercy, etc. One by one. And you just learn one value after another, and then when you've learnt them all, then you're a value-based person. It doesn't work like that. However, we needed to compromise with this perception. And so we provided about a half a page on 50 different values. But really, what we found is either you're a value-based person or you're a fear-based person. If you're a value-based person, you'll have all the values. And if you're a fear-based person, you won't have any of them. Of course, there's a lot of variations within that, but what we are challenging is the idea that you learn values one by one. It's very nice to sit with individual values and think about them, but that's not actually how you learn them. It's a way of focusing on them and developing them, but the larger picture is really the one that actually creates change. Many of you must be figuring out how you become 16 celestial degrees complete and with all the 36 virtues and without any of the vices. And so many people try and create this cosmic scalpel to cut their soul in half and throw away the bad half. Can't be done. Right? And you need your vices for the next time around when you get to the Copper Age and Iron Age, right? If you throw them away now, what's going to happen? So it's really about coming to terms with the different attributes of the self. And what am I like when I'm spiritually in my power? How does that pan out through my values and attitudes and behaviors and way of interacting with people? And then when I'm spiritually weak, how does that pan out? And during the confluence age, you're sometimes in your spiritual strength, and sometimes the influence of spiritual weakness has the greater power, and then at that time all of your spirituality is for the birds, because you're just unable to do anything about it because of that strong magnetic pull. So during the confluence age, you're shifting between being spiritually powerful and being spiritually weak, and slowly you consolidate your strength, and finally you become a person who's absolutely come to terms with your strengths and weaknesses, and then your negative side is essentially neutralized and it's dormant until the next copper age. So now we go into personal development, and this course number 7 is probably the favorite of BKs who really want to work on themselves and become free from anxieties, depressions, some of these things that are just very, very difficult to make them disappear. And so we go into these things through the principles of integrity. And this is a very, very interesting and very deep one, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. And then we also look at the history of character development, the nature of that. And then you see module number 8, we look at values in terms of the whole society. And we start with women's empowerment. And one of the reasons for this is that mostly in the world we live in a patriarchal system, so that the gender balance is quite imbalanced, women are oppressed to a greater or lesser extent. And then these are also the same people who are supposed to be teaching values to the next generation. And so you get a very big difference between socialization of young boys and socialization of young girls, which actually perpetuates the crisis in values, and each generation it gets to be a little worse. And so one of the insertion points there is to educate women to claim their power. And you know that this is very much the thrust of Baba's knowledge. He says you are Shaktis and everyone is a soul, and all souls are brothers, or all souls are Sitas. And really removing this gender bias that is a big problem in the development of a value-based society. And what the problem has produced is addiction, many varieties of addictions. And so we look at addiction. So there's a deep connection between women's empowerment and overcoming addiction. And then we look at the our responsibility to the environment. So you look at it from a very, very deep personal spiritual standpoint, and then you extend that out into the society, and you see what happens when I, the soul, become empowered. The world changes. And what happens when I, the soul, don't become empowered? We go towards a social and environmental disaster. So these are the 8 theoretical modules or courses. And as you go through the courses, you also do module 9. As you know, Baba tells us that we should keep our chart. And this is a way of tracking your development, your spiritual development, the depth of your understanding about values. And it's really all about each participant building their own personal ethical policy. So you work on tracking your meditation development, what goes on in your dialogues, which is a very important part of the program, what you've studied, what you've understood, peripheral videos or books or audio files or radio programs that you have also studied. So it really encourages you to self-educate and track that. And this is also going to accelerate your progress. And it, once you get your diploma, this module number 9 is part of it, because this is the one way in which your process of development can be evaluated. So the 10th one is a research project. You know this slogan, think globally and act locally. This is based on this principle that, having understood through the program much more, in much more detail, about values and about spirituality, you're in a clear position to look at your immediate environment and identify a problem which exists purely and simply because the values are not being applied. And then you'll select that, and you'll use one or another method of researching, and you'll make a report. So in this way, you learn how to make a difference. And this is also part of the evaluation process for the diploma. The 11th course is a spiritual retreat. And so when we're offering the program for BKs, your spiritual retreat takes place in the early morning and in the meditation, and then we do a whole day bhati. And when we're doing this for people who are not BKs, then we include an early morning session in terms of the deepening of their meditation, or we also have a 3 days absolute focus on silence, meditation, spirituality. So there are 3 ways in which this one can be done. And the last one is the ongoing self-sustenance, ongoing self-education. And what we find, because we have small dialogue groups in which we go very much into the depth and we learn structured conversation techniques, which creates a bonding of each one. And so then these groups can be carried on virtually through online technology, and you can very often find lasting friendships. Because when you're working in the dialogue groups, you go very deep with each other, and you start to really understand that we're all in the same boat, and we don't need to put on any show for each other. So it's a very nice way of dropping a lot of the barriers that we have between ourselves. And so to get the diploma, you see, you go through all the modules, you do the dialogues, you hand in your manual of self-progress, your project, your spiritual retreat, and then there is an exam. And we do an exam because we need to have a way to evaluate people so that those who actually come out with this as a qualification, which is given by the Brahma Kumaris Educational Society, you actually have something which is then going to tell somebody that you have been through this course, that you have reached a certain standard of proficiency in applying values and understanding and studying. And this is very often counted in job interviews, and nowadays there are a lot of courses which are looking for value education teachers, and so that can be helpful. So this is what I wanted to show you in terms of just the books and the courses and how it goes. So I'm going to turn off this this projector now. And we can have the normal lights. I want to talk to you about some of the things we discovered in the process of working with this program and experimenting with this program. I guess the lights people aren't here. You saw that I mentioned about, on the one hand you have your conscience, and on the other hand you have the external moral authorities. So one of the things we're doing in this program is getting people to move away from a dependence on external moral authorities and really start to depend upon your own inner moral authority. The external moral authorities say, it's like this, and it's not like that. Do like this, don't do like that. It's very didactic. Now, if you look at the kinds of moral challenges that you get on a daily basis, hardly do you find a situation which can clearly fit into any of these didactic rules and regulations. Every situation needs to be evaluated in its own right. You have to be able to perform something called moral reasoning. You need to be able to get a sense of some of the unseen, subtle factors that may be part of a situation. You have to consider people's feelings. You have to be able to evaluate a number of different attributes of any particular situation so that when you make a decision, you're really taking personal responsibility that, yes, I have thought this through, and according to my ability, this seems to be the right way to go, and then you do it. The importance of this is accountability. Yeah, I want the light on, but there's nobody to turn the light on. It's okay. They may come. Anyway, do you see what I mean? If we say, oh, well, my scripture said it, so if I make a wrong decision, it's not my fault, it's the scripture, or my parents told me, or my senior told me, and so I did like this, then you see we're avoiding accountability. We're avoiding taking responsibility. And that is not an adult position. We want to be able to be strong enough and clear enough and consistent enough to be ready to take responsibility and be willing to be held accountable for the different moral decisions that we make. And if we get accused of something, we have to be able to calculate, is this valid? To what extent is it valid? Is this just somebody trying to give me a put down or disempower me, or what exactly is going on, you see? So in this course, we really work through these things, especially in the dialogue groups, to be able to calculate and evaluate, is this real? Is this right? Is it important? To what extent is it important? Do I have to be worried about something? Can I let this go? All of these subtleties are not things that a child can be expected to learn. This is adult material. And so building your own personal ethical policy is actually pretty much of a lifetime process. And as you observe the decisions that you make, the consequences of those decisions, you're continually refining your ability to make wise decisions, ethically wise, which are socially appropriate, which are good for you, where you're not allowing yourself to be limited or oppressed or put down, but at the same time you have your self-respect and your respect for other people. All of these things need a lot of individual thought. We had some very interesting experiences. For example, we had a course combining a number of elements from the diploma in Malaysia during last year. Is there anyone from Malaysia here? Yes? Yeah. I don't know if you were there. But we were together for about 5 days. And we went deep and deep and deep. And we found that there were about 4 school teachers among the group. And during the dialogue process, all 4 of them started to say, you know what? We are doing child abuse here. We never realized until we got into this dialogue that the way in which we're conducting our classes is actually child abuse. Because they had been in a trend of teaching people right and wrong through extreme punishment. And it was so normal and so conventional that they didn't think. But it suddenly started to dawn on them that, hey, this is not right. This is not how we should do it. See? And they went away actually very changed. Because it's not until a person has a realization that what they're doing is not right. That means the heart will feel it's not right. Otherwise, you know, we're operating on the basis of our head, on the basis of the conventions. This is what we do. Everybody else does it. So you get cut off. Huh? Your head and your heart are just cut. So there's a process of integrating what you understand with your feelings, your sensitivities, and really trusting the inner voice that says, yeah, this may be different from what everybody else is doing, but it's the right way to do things, you see. And once you start to really trust your judgment, your sensitivity, your compassion, your humanity, then you can let go of the influence of external moral authorities, which have a tendency to apply punishment along with deciding this is right and this is wrong. We learn about the laws of karma in our spiritual practice and also in the value education, because the laws of karma are very deep and they apply here very much. The laws of karma, for example, when a person experiences a lot of punishment, corporal punishment, which is very much used, especially in India. I was in Hisar, which is just a bit north of Delhi, and I went to a school called Senior Secondary Boys School, and there were 2,000 boys, 16, 17 years old, and I asked them, how many of you have your father beaten? Everyone's hand went up. I asked them, as a result of that beating, did you get understanding about right and wrong? No, we didn't. We already knew right and wrong. This corporal punishment has absolutely no impact on a person's understanding of right and wrong. What it does, I ask them, if you want to do something and you know that by doing that you're going to get a beating, how are you going to handle it? Oh, they said, we'll make somebody else the scapegoat. They get the beating. So not only does corporal punishment not teach you right and wrong, it also teaches you how to be manipulative, how to pass the blame onto another weaker person. And so it actually encourages people to be dishonest and corrupt. And so we look at some of these conventional practices, and we analyze them. Does this work or not? If it doesn't work, if there's no evidence that it works, is there any reason to continue the practice? Why do we continue practices knowing that they don't work? Only out of habit. Only out of feeling the need to maintain the status quo. But to actually do something different takes a lot of courage. And so we also look at spiritual empowerment. Now, what do I have to do in my meditation, in my churning, in my thinking, so that I can actually be in my self-respect and find the courage to do what's right and represent what's right according to my conscience and yet not be confrontational? Because we've also found that being confrontational is not effective. One has to have a very subtle balance of self-respect and respect for others, and be in such a subtle tuning with what's really right on a number of different levels. You have to be very skillful, you see. Again, this is not something we can expect of a child. This is adult capacities. And so you can imagine that if you're working on a group of adult people as a group, a dialogue group, and the ideal dialogue group is about 40, but that's quite big, and you need a very good moderator for that. 40 is a good dialogue group, because if you get any group of 40 people, you've got pretty much the full spectrum of opinions. You see? You have very liberal people, you have very conservative people, you have very rigid people, you have a few highly dysfunctional people, you have some very wise people, you have some very immature people, a full spectrum. And you work with that group like you're making a cake, you know. And as each one speaks, you're putting new ingredients into the bowl and you start stirring it up, You sit in a circle and you stir up all these ideas. And what happens in this process is whatever is the truth about that particular subject that you're discussing, it starts to emerge. You can't say such and such a sentence is the truth. It's not like that. The truth is like we say there's a ring of truth. And there are times in a dialogue when somebody really gets the point and they say a sentence which is so true and so right that everybody stops. And they know that yes, they have done the work, they have thought about it, churned it. Sometimes it may take 3 or 4 hours to really churn a subject. But once you have got that moment of truth, could be anyone who just puts it into words, and says it, everybody feels it. And when you hear the truth, it makes you go silent, so that the resonance of that sits with you and penetrates with you, and it has the effect of changing us. All of us are untrue to some extent. And how do we become true? Not by being beaten, not by being verbally whipped, but by encountering a true statement, having really looked at the situation in question, and then you feel it, you understand it, you feel it, and the head and the heart of yourself come together and start operating together, and the person becomes more integrated and less fragmented. You find when you do this kind of work in dialogue, of course, very few times do we have a big one like 40. Most people are a little bit more comfortable with about 8 or 10. But still, you meet 2 times, 4 times, 6 times, 8 times, you start to know each other. You remember what each other feels about certain things, what each other has said about certain things. If somebody says one thing on one day and then the opposite on another day, you'll know. They'll know that you know. You have to think, now, what is it? Do I mean this or do I mean that? And someone may ask you, oh, yesterday you said like this, today you're saying like this. Which is it? And you're going to have to give an answer. So you have to go into yourself, and it may be disturbing to have to face the fact that I change my opinion according to the situation. Is that right? What is my opinion anyway? And what's the base of my opinion? You see? So like that, we use the dialogues as a very dynamic form of learning. Everybody's in pretty much in an equal position, and the role of the moderator is to keep the rules of structured conversation adhered to. And the rules are very interesting. We have something called no gas. No generalizations. No accusations, no speculations, and no speeches. These are the rules. And also, that whatever is discussed in the dialogue, you don't go and talk about it outside the dialogue. So there is that respect for the privacy of what people are saying, because sometimes people say things that are very deep, that are very private, and one needs to respect that. When a moderator starts to get you to not speak in generalizations, accusations, speculations, sometimes people say, you know, I'm not allowed to say this, and I'm not allowed to say that, and I'm not allowed to say the other. But you begin to realize that a lot of us speak in generalizations a lot of the time. Most of the time. We do a lot of speculating. Oh, well, you know, all these people are like that. Really? That's a generalization. Even if 99 of them are like that and one of them isn't, then your generalization is not true. So this is one of the things we discover. Generalizations are never true. So you start to have to be able to, or you can only really tell what you know, what you have observed, what you experience. So you have to start saying, well, this is what I felt when I experienced that. You can't speak for anybody else. You can't say we, because who is we? I don't know what you think or what he thinks. You see? And this is one of the ways that gets the truth to come out, because each person is limiting themselves to true statements. And they're learning in the process to articulate their feelings. You know, somebody will say, well, I feel dreadful. Exactly what do you mean by dreadful? Are you experiencing dread? No. I'm uncomfortable. Oh, okay. You know. So we're getting it to be very precise. And once you start getting it precise and clear, your thinking process starts to work much better. And you know sometimes how people have difficulty with churning the knowledge. They can't churn the knowledge. This is a very good way to learn how to churn and how to go deep. So it actually makes you feel so that you've got such an attainment, because you were able to say exactly what you mean, and people would understand you, and you would understand them. And so your connection with the people that you're talking to is also very real. And then when you start to write about these things in your journal, you start to use the language that you use much more fluently and accurately. So your thinking becomes sharper, your conscience becomes sharper, and you're building your sense of self in a very good way. So like that, at the end of the dialogues, people usually feel quite exhilarated, quite stimulated, and changed. The dialogues are alternated with meditation periods, and we have some presentations also. And so, all in all, what we have found with this particular way of working with people is that the variation, sometimes meditating, sometimes discussing, sometimes seeing a presentation, sometimes seeing a film or a video, this variation also keeps the mind alert. And this educational process engages you and involves you so that you feel fresh all the time. So this is also something that we like to do. Now, there's a number of questions people have been having about this. So what I'm going to do now is we've got a couple of mics here, and I'd like to invite you, if you have any questions, to come up to the front and voice your questions through those microphones. And before we start that, one question that people very often ask me is, what is this living values or what? Because we have, in the Brahma Kumaris, three programs on values. And one of them is called Values in Healthcare with the Jenki Foundation. One of them is called Living Values. And then this one, which is called Value Education, or the Diploma of Education in Values and Spirituality. So Living Values is a program which is using activities, and the system of using activities to understand the depth of values is also applied in the Values in Healthcare program of the Jenki Foundation. In the Value Education program, we don't really use activities. We do use the dialogue program, which is interactive, but it's more of a study. There's a lot of content that you need to read and work with, and Living Values was very much oriented for children in schools. Values in Healthcare is oriented towards the healthcare practitioners, and this one here, Value Education, is really oriented towards BKs, experienced BKs. and our contact souls who are interested in spirituality and values and interested in really going to the depth of it. So it's quite a bit academic type of program. And so it's a different kind of approach. But this just so that you understand the difference between the three. So I saw one or two hands going up, so you please come up and... Oh, another product, yes. Values in the workplace. Ah, that's right. I'm not very familiar with it, but this is something in South America. Yeah, values in the workplace. And I don't know any details about that, but this is a fourth one. And so you can see that people are really focused on the subject of values, which in terms of Gyan, we have Gyan, Yoga, Dharana, and Service. And eventually what's going to remain is Dharana, which is really values, you know. In the golden age, we will all be value-based. We will not be meditating, we will not be studying, and we will not be doing any service, but we will all be Dharana Murat, these embodiments of values. So I think it's interesting that we are now shifting towards a very great focus on values itself. Does anybody have any other questions? Yes, please. Yes, you can. Let's take the sister first and then you come second.
I'm just curious regarding the guest that you mentioned. As a moderator, does the moderator from time to time remind in the conversation that, you know, you're now doing the speculation or accusation, or et cetera, et cetera? And if you can give an example of each, please.
Yes. When I've been experimenting with this, I have told all the people that I'm promised to disturb you a lot. So they know that some interruption and interference is going to happen and they're not going to get fed up with me. And I tell them that in my function, if I'm the moderator, my function is to keep you on the subject, to keep you within the time. We get people to speak not more than 2-3 minutes at one time. And so if you speak longer than that, then it's a speech. If you say what you've said more than twice, it's a speech. And then if you break any of these no-gas rules, I'm going to come in there and stop you. Is it okay? And then they tell me, yes, it's okay. And so then when I do it, they don't mind. So it's very important for the moderator to let the people know that the rules will be enforced in this particular way. And within about 2 sessions, everybody gets it. And then the moderator basically is hardly required, you know. But because these rules are new and different, and because people are just not aware of the extent to which they violate them on a daily basis, it starts with a lot of disturbance. And one of the things I found, the first group that we did was for 21 days. And that was 2 years ago, and I had 80 Brahma Kumaris from all over India, center teachers, who could more or less speak English. And they, we had the whole of Sukhdam. So we had one room which was our classroom on the top floor, and then they occupied all the rooms. And it was the monsoon, so it's absolutely pouring with rain. And there was nothing else going on at all, just us. And our groups, you know. And they started to have conversations with each other in English, so they could brush up their English. And they started to really use these rules in their day-to-day life. A second group that I worked with was for 1 year. I had 40 lecturers from a university in South Gujarat. And I used to come there every Sunday morning, and from 9 o'clock till 1 o'clock we were together. And these people started to apply it in their families, in their classrooms very quickly, because they just saw, yes, this is very applicable. And then I also have had some groups of people in different centers. We did this in the Philippines, in Malaysia, in Singapore, a little bit in California, a little bit in South Africa. And the people started to, you know, really adopt these techniques in their interactions within centers, you see. And they found that they're very useful for communication and so on. So the idea is to really empower BKs and anyone else. But it's really so grounded in Gyan, which has been very churned by people who've really gone through a lot of their process in their years as BKs to put all this together. And so you should find, if you use it, that it's really going to move you forward through communication issues in your center, through personal issues inside your head, through the balancing of laukic and alaukic, how to say no when you have to say no, and yes when you have to say yes. All of these very, very practical things, ways of being able to live as a mature, reasonable human being with conscience and self-respect. So this is really the idea of the program. So it applies very much to BKs, and it's also very a nice program that can be offered to contact souls and so on. For some, it's a good bridge. You bring people to the center. They don't want to hear about, you know, God and celibacy and all this, you know. But they want to develop themselves spiritually, and they want, and they like values. So it actually forms a good bridge for people to study, and it makes them absolutely ready to go into the 7 days course if they're, you know, if they're up for the real spiritual practice. Yes.
Sister, in India, we find a large gap between what the academia is giving and what the workplace is really expecting. What they learn in school and colleges and what they need in the workplace. They need a good attitude, adjusting to situations, etc. So how can we bridge this gap between the academia and the expectation of, in terms of values and in terms of this education, especially by imparting these to the lecturers, thereby reaching the students?
Yes, a very, very good question. And what we have experienced is that there is, in India, all of the universities have something called academic staff colleges, where the lecturers get further education. And our proposal is to go there, to the academic staff colleges, because it's really the lecturers who need this more than the students. Because when you're an undergraduate, or even if you're in a master's program, you're still pretty young, and you haven't really come into your own as a fully functioning professional, socially empowered person, whereas the teachers are. And they are the role models, and they're the authority figures for the students. And so I'm very interested in bringing that in there. And the teachers that I have worked with in a few different places, for example, in Madras University, in some of the universities around Hisar and Delhi and in Bombay, and here and there we've started to do a little bit, and it's been very successful. I think probably the most successful program we did was in October. there's a private educational trust with 30,000 students in Gujarat, just near to Anand, a place called Vallabh Vidyanagar. And the trust is called Charutar Vidya Mandal. And they have 24 colleges, scientific, arts, all the different things. And so what happened was the president of this trust came and met me. And he said, I want to bring all the college principals of all the colleges and you teach them this thing. So I said, yes. And they came for 5 days. And we did a tailor-made program for them. And for the first day, they were all, we don't have to pick a student, who are you, and what is this, you know, and all that. And then we took them through dialogues, and we started to get them to, you know, study the material. And, you know, they changed dramatically. It was the first time in their entire history of 80 years that all the college principals had got together ever. First time ever. And they sort of saw each other across the campus, but they didn't really know each other. And we had the dialogues of everyone together, 24 at once. And we did very subtle, touchy subjects. And we had a big variation of attitudes and people, there were people who had what I consider to be really good values. And there were people who were very, you know, arrogant and all that, you know, the full spectrum. And they started to talk to each other and hear themselves. And it started to change. You can watch it before your very eyes over the 5 days. And because they were here, you know, they were away from all of their other things and away from their families. And one of them was a musician, very, very good musician. And in the last evening, he gave a concert. And it was gorgeous, you know, sitar concert. And one of them was an artist. And so we had the slideshow of his paintings. And the others didn't know. They'd never heard this musician play. They'd never seen, you know, they didn't know each other at all. They were just working in the same place and gathering their pay. But afterwards, what you got was a campus with all of these colleges, and all the principals knew each other. And it became more of a family where people became more sensitive to the reality of who each other was. And then at the end of it, they said, no, we want all the teachers in the individual colleges to come as a group, you know. And so I think this process of creating a cohesion between people who are working together is very much something that advances people's sense of what's right and wrong. We also did work with Infosys, with Jindal Steel, you know, in different industries, you see, so that when the people are really in the situation, when they suddenly find that their school has not at all prepared them, they're getting something where they can actually learn how to say what they need to say and how to get in touch with what they need to get in touch with and bring all the different parts of themselves into an integrated whole. And so it seems that, you know, going in there in terms of the educational establishments to the teachers, and then in terms of the businesses into the management and so on, because whatever is happening at the top level, it's going to have a lot of impact to the people who are further down in the organizational structure. Whereas if you just go to the lowest levels of the organizational structure, people are going to say, well, they obviously need some values, but we are perfectly all right, you know. And it doesn't do the job. But when you start to get the people who are the decision makers, the people who are the policy makers, and get them to experience personally the humanizing impact of this, and that they start to come alive in new ways, and then they want to bring this benefit into the other parts of the organization. So we're working in that way, trying always to go to the higher levels.
Any plans for the colleges, especially in the south of India? You once visited our college, so we are expecting you to come back again to we had an orientation. You remember you came to Madurai Tyagaraja School of Management.
Yes, yes.
So they are again, they wanted to establish as a course for their teachers
so
as well.
What we're going to do is we're going to do some cloning because my problem is that it's been difficult to get people to have enough time with the program to become really good teachers of it. So this is one of my issues, that I cannot physically go to all the different places. In the audience we have Brother Girish. Would you like to just stand up and So Brother Girish and I are sort of basically doing this whole thing, and we have a few people in other cities who are beginning to have some exposure to the program, but really a person needs to go through it fully, maybe two or three times, to really get a good feel of it, so that they can then become a teacher of it and deliver it. So this is the thing, and this is why yesterday I was meeting with a person who can enable us to put all this sort of educational technology onto the internet, so that you can, in your own time, because people are very busy, and if you're a student of anything except MBA, you're getting an added workload every year because new information keeps coming into the scientific world, so you don't have time to learn these things. But maybe at 5 o'clock in the morning, after your meditation and before your morning class, you can just go onto your computer and listen to a value education audio file. And maybe you can gather together a group of 10 or 12 people who are interested and have a dialogue group. And if you want to have an international dialogue group, you can get in on the internet to a virtual group and meet at a particular time. And in that way, you can create friends across time zones, across geographical areas, and really expand your horizon. So we're trying to use the internet technology to allow for this. Because it's just, you know, distances and time and everything is too big to manage without using those things. But we'll come anyway. Anybody else had anything they would like to talk about? Please, yeah.
There is any possibilities to bring these courses in distance education?
Well, we have thought about it a lot. And what we found, there are a number of universities which approached us, and basically what they wanted was to just make a lot of money. They were not really very interested in providing what it takes to inspire a person to develop their values and spirituality. So that was one obstacle. The second obstacle is that most of the distance education formats are quite simple, about accumulating information. The nature of this study doesn't lend itself so well to distance education, because it's not just an accumulation of facts. So what we are thinking at this time is to get people to come for a 5-day residential course, at least one. And if they want to do all 10, that's great, and they're up for the diploma. But as soon as you've done one course, you can start to get onto the net and get further sustenance through the audio files, video files, and so on. And you can start to be in a group or continue with the group that you were with. You see, and in that way, you're using the internet technology, but it's not just this dry distance education that you want you want a piece of paper so you can get a job. That's what distance education is about. And so we decided that that wasn't for us. Any other?
I remember when you gave an introduction to this in San Francisco, I believe. And one of the suggestions that you somewhat alluded to today was to have BKs have these small focus groups amongst their own. And I think in theory, having thought about that for quite a while, that it's a good concept, but I'm kind of wondering in practice, for people who are seeing the need to use it, that you would, you know, kind of create the similar dynamics or attributes or attitudes even amongst yourself, and how can we break away from that knowing that there's very few facilitators to implement the program?
Well, since I did that in San Francisco, we've also gone further along the way, and we've developed some things like the audio files, the PowerPoints, and so on, which are going to help people. And also, because now the program is in its sort of fifth or sixth year, there's more and more people who are aware about it, and we've found ways to empower people better, to provide people with more material, and also to go and help people become moderators, you see. So as the time goes by, it's becoming more effective. I'm supposed to go there again in the summer and sort of get it going in the new Anubhuti retreat place. I think that's a signal for a traffic control. It's 12 o'clock. Or do we wait another 2-3 minutes? Yeah, I think we have another 2-3 minutes. With the use of the expanded internet, we can get people to actually log in, because what we found in San Francisco is people couldn't even actually physically come and meet each other. But most people have their PCs, and it does become possible to log in. You know, just like you have a Skype conversation. So it's a bit like that with several people. And we'll be experimenting with that and seeing how people go with that. But what we have found is these days the virtual meetings are happening more and more in the business communities and so on. So there isn't any good reason why it couldn't be used quite effectively for this. And so we're working with some new software that's going to allow that. You see, you have somebody in San Francisco itself, then you have somebody in Novato, and then you have somebody in Fremont, and then you have somebody in Emeryville, and the traffic is such that even though it's only 6 or 7 miles, you don't want to deal with the traffic, you see. And so even if you're not too far away, it's still worthwhile using the internet technology when you don't have very much time. But you can put together 1 hour on a Monday evening, 8 to 9 or something, you know, where everybody decides that, yeah, we can give an hour. There's no traveling involved. So that makes it just that much easier. Yeah.
I was just wondering, Denise, is there going to be a small training while we're here, or?
We thought about that, but it was decided that it'd be better to do just a couple of hours like this. And so then you all know basically what it's about. And then we can see later on about introducing some trainings or making it possible in the future. You know, another aspect that I should also mention is that when we started doing this, it was thought that this would just be operating in India. But now, because people in other countries have had a little taste of it and got a little experienced in it, I may ask Becky to come up and just talk a little bit about how it's being used in the Philippines. And so because it's being used in a few other places, so it was thought that let me explain this to the larger group so that you have some kind of exposure to it, and then we see how it goes from there.
I don't know you speak English, but I ask, do you go to Brazil?
Maybe. Let's have traffic control and then we talk more. So I just talk a little bit about Brazil. Luciana Ben did ask me about this because of the Values in the Workplace program, and they're going to put a big values program together, so it's a possibility. Now, I was speaking with Brother Ken with the idea of bringing all the different values programs under an umbrella, and Brother Bridge Mohan Bhai was telling me that there is a plan to create a values institute at Abu Road, just near Shantivan, an actual building with different classrooms, you know, in which people can study the different values programs that we have, and which would also be a women's studies center. So in this way, you can see that we're slowly taking on the form of a spiritual university in a bit of more of an academic way, with the syllabus and diplomas and all this kind of thing. And you can see it's a sort of logical next step in the drama. What a lot of people have been doing from different countries is just coming and buying the set of books and in their own time slowly reading them through, because I think before you really do a training in it, it's very good to just, you know, take time and slowly, slowly go through the material, let it sink in, and then you really know it. And then the question of the training is more like for the delivery of it, and then for using some of these processes, like the dialogues and so on. So I'm going to ask Sister Becky to come and talk to us, because Sister Becky is a very experienced facilitator in the Philippines, and we did a program there during last year, and she has been continuing with it, so her experience would be quite valuable.
Om Shanti. So last May 2006, Denise Mann came to the Philippines. We had a two-day retreat for BK and non-BKs. And from there, we chose eight units, which is supposed to be the certificate course. And what we did was just to go invite some of the BKs who are interested to go through the content. Because the content is very, very... As Denise was saying, you need to read it, you need to see the content, plus the fact that every time we go through a content, we would always ask the students who were attending what had been changed, in the sense that what were added on or clarified in terms of the gyan that we know. Okay, so all of those things, how could we apply it? Just very simple, just a little bit discussion. And then... Because Denise Ben did the positive thinking, which I find very good for a retreat, and we have a retreat center, we offered it several times to public. So it's actually a retreat on positive thinking, which is very different from the usual positive thinking. And a lot of people who actually attended it like it very much, but it has to be a kind of a retreat format in which you go into meditation, because the even for just reading again the positive thinking, it made a lot of difference, because it's a very different kind of positive thinking that we know. And I think it's very good even for the Brahmins to go through it, particularly there are 18 principles of positive thinking, and just to allow the participants to just go through it and mark themselves before they go into the retreat whether they have those principles or not. It's actually a big revelation that a lot of them, even BKs, don't have the principle to realize that they are not actually positive as BKs. Is actually a first discovery, and then after that we went through the whole module and then have a realization that they are not really positive. I think these are little things that we are doing in terms of this, because the materials is very rich, and I think it gives us also a lot of, allows us to use Gyan in a way that people are not turned off, because they're really very exploratory, and I like the no gas. I practice it myself. Sometimes when we conduct retreat, even meetings, we try to do it, if you remember, to actually articulate it. And I think it's very good for us to use Baba's Gyan in a way to enrich ourselves and also others. The next step is really inviting some of those who already had some taste to fit with Denise, and then ask them to form with us some discussion groups. Not the dialogue yet, because none of us are really trained. I'm a trainer, but I find the dialogue which is needed for this, I think it has to, you have to be trained to it, with it more. I've been a facilitator for the last 20 years of my life, and it's quite different. And therefore, I think we have to, I mean, you have to work first on yourself, and I think deepen our own understanding, and then we can do it. But that's what we're doing in the Philippines. It's very exciting in a way, and it actually helped a lot of Brahmins to look at their Brahmin life differently also. So we'll have a second part and deepen with those who wanted to stay with the group. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Becky. So, is there anybody else? Otherwise, we can close. Anything? Okay, so, yes. Okay. You come up here because I can't hear you.
You mentioned that only 9 of the 12 books were published. Could you? 10. Could you share which ones are not?
Well, which ones are not published? They're basically the instructions. The instructions for the spiritual retreat and the instructions for the ongoing sustenance. Those are not published, but they're not, we can do it very well without it, so it's all right. Yeah. But the 10 books are there. And if anybody's interested in those, they're in hall number 12 and they're 50 rupees each. Brother Girish was just asking me to share with you. Everybody got this sheet, right? It should have been on your chair. Some of them at the back may not have it. So if you don't have one, come to the front. There'll be quite a lot on front seats. And it just gives you basic information, and it gives you the contact email and the website that you can have a look at. The other thing that I would like to share with you is a survey form that we ask people to fill in. Because we're doing some research on values, and we're trying to create what's called a standardized test to evaluate people's values. And we've been asked to do this by a number of universities and colleges, because they really don't know, or they don't have an instrument for evaluating these things. So this is actually a kind of a PhD level project, and so it's going to take us 2 or 3 years to do this. But I'll give you an example of some of the questions we ask people, and we're asking them to say agree, undecided, or disagree. And we have on this particular test 120 questions. Gradually you work with these tests on a number of different people, and you find some of the questions people don't understand very well, or they're not very clear or whatever, so you have to make certain changes until you finally come up with the questions that are really clear. For example, only artists have creativity. Agree, disagree, undecided. You see, so there would be some variation on that. The more money I have, the more I would be worthy of respect. And so this lets a person know, or indicates whether a person's materialistic, or to what extent a person is materialistic. And one of the principles of values and spirituality is that the more materialistic you are, the more it erodes your spiritual values. And so, for example, if a person comes into the course totally materialistic, they may change that, because they might see that in a different light, because it's presented in a different light. Another one is, spirituality is necessary for living in harmony with others. Yes. But if somebody says no, then it means they haven't really thought about what spirituality is or what its value is, you see. And so in the course they'll have exposure to it, and then they may say, well, maybe yes. And so then we get them to fill in the form before they do the course, and then at the end of the 5 days, and we see the difference. So we have done this with quite a lot of people, and we plotted the differences in graphs, and we found that pretty much in every case they have increased their level of values as a result of studying the material. Criminals can be corrected through punishment because rehabilitation is ineffective. I see. So somebody who says no, it means they've thought about it. They're a little bit different from the norm. Somebody who says yes, it means that they're ready to apply violence, you know, shoot now and first and ask questions later kind of thing. Meditation has nothing to do with God. And a lot of people will say yes. I mean, when I first took my course and I wanted to learn meditation, and when Sister Genty said, well, do you believe in God? I said, well, what does that have to do with it? You know, and that's private anyway. I see. Meditation is unsuitable for scientific people. Consciousness is a byproduct of the brain. Having double standards is justified. Enjoying sensual pleasure is beneficial for your emotional and physical health. Childhood trauma is the main cause of character defects. Girls do not need to know about human reproduction before marriage. Money, expediency, and short-term benefits are necessary for prosperity. People in high positions do not need to be concerned about the law. There's no such thing as God. In each birth, a person gets a new soul from God. Coming under the influence of others is inevitable. Secrecy and confidentiality are the same. Using women's bodies to advertise your product is the best way to succeed. If I do not satisfy my physical desires, there is danger of mental illness. You know, so it covers lots of people's preconceptions, ideas that indicate whether a person is inclined towards being judgmental, violent, whether they're caring or not, all these different kinds of things, so that we gradually come up with the final questionnaire that can be then used in a number of different institutes to evaluate people's values. And once you start using these kinds of instruments in a general way, then it means the whole question of spiritual values or eternal values gets quite high in people's minds and competes for position with the materialistic values. And in that way you begin to change people's thinking. Okay, so I'd like to thank you very much for your kind attention. And on your sheet there is my email, there's the website, so please have a look at that. Bear in mind the website is going to be very much changed and expanded during this year so that it can be very useful for you. And if you have any questions or whatever, you have a question? Yes, okay.
Is it okay? Yeah. You talk about, you said either a person is value-based person or either is a person who has fear.
Fear-based.
Fear-based, yeah. Can you just explain a little bit more?
Well, if you think about yourself, you have your conscience. You have your understanding about what's right and wrong. And then some situation comes where you go against your conscience. Why? Analyze it. Pretty usually it comes down to some kind of fear. Could be fear that you're going to lose face or lose money or people won't like you or they'll marginalize you or it will hurt too much or... But it's usually some kind of fear that makes a person lie or that makes a person do what they know is wrong. If you say, okay, no, it's not fear, it's desire. I want to steal this thing, it looks good to me, I think I'll take this away. why? Scarcity. Your desires are at their bottom. It's because, you know, I need it. Something weak inside, you see. So if a person follows the voice of their conscience, you know, they're very strong. You know, it takes great courage to listen to the voice of conscience. People really don't like truth. It's upsetting, it's unpleasant, it's ugly, it makes you look bad, all these things. And so for a person to make their personal policy that I will live according to the principles of truth, you've got to be strong like Daddy Jenki. You know? And this is why she keeps on teaching us in the way that she does, because she wants all of us to start to get strong and let go of fear. There's a quite well-known book, Love is Letting Go of Fear. Love is Daddy Prakashmani, the most loving person. You had to be very strong, very wealthy inside to be able to love. And so what we're trying to do with this program is to really encourage people to take advantage of Baba's great offerings of peace and love and power and wisdom and all of these things, and make it your own and make it the base of your life. And this program is simply a structured way of putting the gyan in this kind of format, so that you can learn it and develop it using some of these techniques, you see. So it would help you in your BK life to be a really strong value-based BK. Whatever your weaknesses are, everybody has some weakness, to be able to face it, to be able to come to terms with it, to be able to neutralize it, and find your power. Okay, so thank you very much, and Om Shanti.